Hey, what's going on? This is Jeremy Thoe, Marketing Director of 3PL Systems and host of 3PL Live. I'm excited to share an interview with my friend Will Daines. Will is a certified financial planner. He used to work at Deloitte and Touche and also GE in the finance department. In this episode, we talk all about cash flow, specifically the freight wage cash flow crisis at Silicon Valley Bank, and then just also how much cash you should have on hand as an individual or a business. I have to read a quick disclosure before we start the episode. The subject matter and the communication is educational only and provided with the understanding that the principal is not rendering legal, accounting, investment, or tax advice. You should consult with appropriate counsel, financial professionals, and other advisors with matters pertaining to legal, tax, investment, or accounting obligations and requirements. Insurance products issued by Principal Life Insurance Company, except in New York, and Principal Life Insurance Company and the companies available through the Preferred Product Network, Inc. Securities and advisor products offered through the Principal Securities, Inc. Member SIPC. Reference companies are members of the Principal Financial Group, Des Moines, Iowa, 50392. Securities are not FDIC or NCUA insured, may lose value, not a deposit insured by any federal agency. Will Daines, Principal National and Principal Life Financial Representative, Principal Securities Registered Representatives Financial Advisor, Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, CFP Board owns the certification marks CFP and CFP with plaque design in the United States, which authorizes the use of individuals who successfully complete CFB Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements, 289-395-870-723. Thanks so much, and let's start the episode.
Hey, Will, thanks for coming on to 3PL Live. I am excited to talk to you on this episode all about cash flow. For those people that don't know you, would you just mind introducing yourself?
Sure. Yeah, it's great to be here, Jeremy. I appreciate you having me on and looking forward to our conversation today. So like you said, my name is Will. I'm a certified financial planner. My background ever since college has been in finance. I did some work with GE, General Electric, and then Deloitte Consulting in the large corporate finance space. That gave me an interesting experience being kind of on that side of the spectrum in finance. And then great experiences, had a lot of fun, met a lot of great people, learned a lot, and then decided that the Fortune 500 experience I could bring down to more of a small to medium-sized business and personal level. So transitioned down to kind of that space, is doing kind of the financial planning consulting, and I've really enjoyed it.
I bet, yeah. Did you learn a lot at some of the bigger companies that helped you kind of, I guess, stay organized with your, I guess, smaller operation? I would imagine that you probably learned a ton of like organizational skills.
Yeah, you know, I absolutely did. I mean, one thing that I think is fascinating that I always tell people when they ask me about the difference, you know, it's unique being able to go from, you know, large Fortune 500 consulting company now to more small, medium-sized businesses. If you haven't had the experience of being on that side of the spectrum, one thing that always stood out to me is while the people were phenomenal and obviously great services, great products, it was interesting to me that oftentimes you'd be surprised because of all of like mergers and acquisitions and things of that nature, that while there were some very robust and rigorous systems and processes, there was also sometimes it's surprising how ad hoc things were run out of Excel or maybe not as buttoned up as outside people would think. So it was interesting to see kind of that dynamic, that tension.
It is fascinating to think about that. I heard someone actually talking about this the other day. They called it Flintstoning, when not everything is so together on the front end, or, you know, on the front end, it looks like they're together, but in the back end, they're doing all these like kind of non-scalable things. Let's talk a little bit about the freight waves crisis and what happened there. And as far as like keeping cash reserves in the bank as an individual or as a business, what exactly happened there with that whole scenario? And how did they get, we're not singling them out or anything, but how did they get into that mess?
Yeah, great question. Again, some people probably read a lot about this. Some people may not know so much. And you're 100% right, too, not to single freight waves out. It just so happens that they're maybe one of the bigger industry players that got caught up in it. But essentially, you know, what happened is freight waves, along with, again, and you know, not to single them out, many, many other firms, typically trending more towards tech and kind of venture capital, more oriented firms, were all basically had most of their cash, in some cases, all of their cash, with one bank. The positive nature of that was you could have a bunch of services and relationships that were designed and oriented towards those types of businesses, which is phenomenal. The problem is, and what came up recently, is that Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, they had essentially what it came down to was a diversification risk. They weren't diversified enough. And I'll talk about that in a second. And they also didn't have a very good job as far as managing interest rate risk. How that pertained then to a firm like FreightWaves or a company like FreightWaves or anybody else that had their funds there is that because they had everything there, and typically you're going to have, for this all, this event happened, you're going to have all of your cash tied up, and you might have a $250,000. In some cases, you can have about $2.5 million, depending on the structure. Sure, if you hear that your bank is suddenly going to go out of business and all the deposits are going to be essentially lost, then you start pulling money out. And what was unique about this event is that because you had a bunch of companies that knew each other, right? And like there were plenty of reports that came out that some of the people that had their, you know, CEOs and firm owners that had their funds at Silicon Valley Bank were on the same text chain, WhatsApp chat, whatever. And so once it became evident that there might've been some issues at the bank, they all started messaging and communicating. And because of the nature of how things work these days, we're able to pull out their cash quickly. And it's just like a good old fashioned run on the bank, yanking all your funds out. And so if you're a company, whether it be FreightWaves or again, not to single them out, but to so many other firms that had cash with that entity, with Silicon Valley Bank, all of a sudden you're like, well, how am I maybe going to make payroll, or how are we going to do things? How are we going to operate if we have all of our cash, potentially millions, in this one entity that is suddenly potentially insolvent? That's what happened to FreightWaves, specifically to Silicon Valley Bank. And what they ran into is, like I said, diversification. They had almost all their clients were a certain sector, right? All in kind of generally more of a tech startup-y venture capital space. So they didn't diversify their client base and their depositors. And then the collateral they had on their balance sheet to kind of offset those deposits was not well positioned, given that we've had interest rates the Fed's been raising interest rates. And that really hurt the collateral they had on their book. So it's kind of like a perfect storm. And for then anybody that, like we said, like a FreightWaves that had their cash there, it was a very hectic week or two time period, even a few day period of, are we going to get our cash back and how are we going to run our business?
I think that the government bailed that bank out, right? But so a bank run, is that basically just like a psychological thing where people freak out and they start pulling out their money, and then all of a sudden everyone starts creating like a mass, like hysteria type thing where everyone runs out and wants to take it out? That's kind of the psychology of it?
Absolutely. And it is so much of that. And that's why it was a little different as far as, like you said, the government definitely came and put up a backstop for saying that all depositors. So traditionally it's been at each individual bank that's FDIC insured, that is insurance that usually will assure you up to 250,000. So of course, you've got millions there, you don't feel very good about only having insurance for 250,000. And so what the government did is they didn't necessarily bail out the whole bank, right? But what they did do is they came in and told everybody pretty quickly and within a matter of days, hey, we're going to make all of the depositors whole. And so what that did, exactly what you said, from a psychological standpoint, is it made people at least feel a little bit safer to not necessarily run in and pull all their money out of other banks that maybe had a similar clientele or a similar financial profile. And it's 100% what you said. It's a psychological thing by the government saying, like, don't worry, we've got this. They kind of stopped that contagion effect and stopped kind of that hysteria of people just yanking their money out of banks.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about like cash flow, how much you should have on hand as like an individual, and then also like freight brokers as well, because freight brokers have a weird situation where they have to pay the carrier, and sometimes it's like net, I don't know, 60 days, 30 days after they get paid, and they have to float that bill. So can you just talk a little bit from like an individual, and then also like maybe like a freight brokerage, what you suggest for cash flow reserves?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So on the personal side, the standard that's kind of thrown out there is always 3 to 6 months of expenses. And that I always look at a lot of these kind of rules of thumb as great starting point. Personal side, maybe a little easier to understand. So if you think, hey, I've got to make, you know, my mortgage payment, my rent, I got to pay my electric bills, got to pay for whatever expenses you have for yourself, for your family. And then you say, it's not necessarily a fun exercise. It's very important. As you say, well, if I were to lose my job or a significant portion of however I have my income, what would I need for 3 to 6 months to pay my bills until I get back on my feet or find this new environment? So that's a great place to start. 3 to 6 months of your expenses. Now, I've come across clients and people that they're just risk averse and they like to hold 12 months of cash kind of somewhere on hand because it makes them feel more comfortable, makes them sleep well at night. And I've had other people that are a little more, you know, like risk taking or risk tolerant, and maybe be less than 3 months. Now that's getting a little bit risky depending on where you're getting your income, you know, if you're in a 2-income household. But again, 3 to 6 months is a great place to start. And then you start to navigate either above or beyond that depending on your personal situation. For a company, especially like you said, in the freight brokerage space, what you really need to do, because it's such a diverse industry and you've got, like you said, depending on how your brokerage is, how many customers you have, how many shippers, because of it being so unique, it's still good to start with like a 3 to 6 month time horizon as far as you look at your P&L, your balance sheet, and kind of get a, or your P&L, your cash flow, and get a sense for what you would need. It can be much more nuanced, where if you're in a position that you take a look and you say, given our clientele, given who we typically work with, given our payment terms, we feel like if we were to even lose, let's say, you know, 50% of our revenue, and we're able to actually, you know, carry cash for 6 months, then you could feel much more comfortable on the 6 month time horizon. On the other hand, let's say that you're dependent on a smaller subset of customers. Typically, you're getting your payments from a much smaller people. They make up much higher percentage of revenue. You may need to have even potentially more than that. So it is looking at your individual expenses, your cash flow, exactly what you said about 60-day payment terms, and getting a sense for kind of doing that kind of that stress test of if we were to lose, getting a good starting point is doing it incremental percentages. We were to lose 10%, 25%, and then 50% of revenue, how long could we last? And that's a good place to start as far as how much cash you want to have on hand. And again, there's also an element of like what's feasible, right? I mean, all of us would love to have 5 years of cash on hand. That's at least a good starting point of having a little bit of cash set aside, given those time horizons and those percent decreases in revenue.
Fair point. What about as far as, let's talk a little bit about factoring. So like, as far as like, I know that a lot of brokers use factoring companies is to float the receivables faster. Could you explain exactly what factoring is and how that works, and maybe some things to at least avoid, maybe, or not necessarily avoid, but just to be aware of?
Yeah, absolutely. So so factoring, it's all around being intentional of how you use it and using it strategically. So, you know, what factoring is, you know, you go ahead and do, you know, provide a service, and then you're, like we talked about before, there's some period of payment terms, and depending on the quality of the people who are going to be paying you, it may take you a lot of effort to chase down those payments. Ideally, that's not the case, but we all know that that can be the case sometimes. And so between either you not wanting to spend the time and resources on chasing down receivables, or I should say, you feel like by getting the cash now versus waiting 30, 60, 90 days, you can do something more powerful with that cash and giving up somewhere between 2-5% on what you would have received. That's where factoring comes in. So basically you go to a factoring, you know, so somebody's going to factor for you and you say, hey, I've got this much, you know, let's say it's 100. I mean, make the numbers easy, right? Here, you know, here's $100 for the receivables. They pay you $95. And so, you know, you've got your cash. And now depending on the business model you have, because you got that $95, sometimes more like 97, 98, in my example, but because you got that money now, you can go off and do something else with it, right? And turn that money into something even more. And you can make more profit on that cash. Also, the company that is doing your factoring, that is what they do. They track down receivables. They would say that they're pretty good at it. That's how they can make their money. They're much better at it than you might be. So even though they paid you $95, they feel like more often than not, they can go get that full 100, and that's where they're going to make their margin. So that's how it works. And then as far as how you should think about using it, again, there's intentionality around it. So where I see people run into issues is when you're using it as an emergency measure. And so what we've talked about in past conversations, you and I, is likening it to some type of painkiller. Like if you use that because, you know, you were sore or you're getting over some type of ailment and you use it responsibly, pain meds are great. If you all of a sudden get into a point where you're kind of abusing it or relying on it too much, we know that those can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so factoring can be the same way. If you find that you're short on payroll or another type of operational cost, and you find yourself getting into this kind of vicious negative feedback loop or cycle of factoring all the time, you're just basically taking on a permanent decrease to your margins, to your profit, which is not good. And it can be hard to get out of that. That's the negative, right? But where can it be good? Well, we already talked about if you can get money from factoring and you get that money into your business and you can turn that around and make more of a profit off of it, that can be a huge benefit. If you look at the math and you say, it's going to cost me, based on my customer base, on the shippers I have to track down, it's going to cost me a lot of money to hire extra accounts receivable people and collectors, then that could be another reason of being intentional about having the factoring company do it for you as well. I also even saw, you know, an interesting thing too is a little, and this is something I was reading up on even today, is a little bit of a liability. So if you feel like there's a risk that your receivables people, you know, given the tight environment we're in right now in freight, where they might not pay to you, you kind of unload that risk and say, hey, if they go bankrupt or never get to pay me, that risk is being moved over to the factoring company. So a lot of very positive ways to use it. The key is using it intentionally and strategically, not using it as an emergency stopgap measure that you're just never going to get out of.
That's totally fair. I like what you said there about using it intentionally, the factoring in and strategically. How do these factoring companies even afford to do it on such low margins? I don't really understand that point either. Is there just a lot of automation or something? Or how do you think? Obviously, we're not in the factoring business, but what's your guess on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And like exactly what you said, I don't want to like profess to be some factoring expert. And so happy to, you know, anybody that has feedback or comments, happy to hear that. But generally, it's they're really good. Like what they do is collect receivables. And so if like what do you do as a freight broker? You're really good at what you do. And you're not maybe your bread and butter is not necessarily tracking down receivables and people that need to pay. So the factoring companies are really good at it. Also, depending on how they operate, and it's a little bit harder now, but they might have the way that they're getting their capital. So I went back to my example of if you give them $100 receivable and they give you $95, that $95 they gave you, they based on their structure and how they have cash that they're paying out, they have may have managed their cash in a more effective way that it costs them pretty low cost of capital to pay that out. And then again, because they're able to go out there and collect that full $100 more often than not, that's where they make their margins. So that's how they do it. They're just really good at collecting it. And that like $5 difference that they make plus the low cost of capital to give you that money up front is how they can be profitable.
So what's the deal with like the Federal Reserve when they raise like interest rates? I know that we've been kind of hiking interest rates now for quite a while. I think that to buy a house now it's something like around like 5 or 6% to buy. So I'm just curious, like what's going on with that? Are they sucking out liquidity into the market or is this making the cost of money more expensive, which should slow down the economy essentially? Is that kind of part of it to curb inflation? I know it's a lot there, but
yeah. No, I mean those are great points. So what they're effectively doing, and you'll have people that disagree on this, but like the conventional wisdom on you know why the Fed would raise rates in an environment like this is at least in name is to lower inflation. And so it's the standard kind of equation of if you got too much demand, you know, coming out of the pandemic, we had a ton of demand. And as we all know here on this podcast, you know, we had a bunch of issues you know, with supply chains. There were other kind of wrinkles in the economy that needed to be worked out. So you had a lot of demand chasing not a lot of goods and supply. And so we had inflation. And so one of the Fed's most effective policy tools is they can just go and start raising rates. And so what that effectively does is kind of what you alluded to is where people would be going out and whether it's on the personal side, you know, you going out and purchasing stuff, you know, personally, because you don't have to pay that high of a rate on it, you know, whether it's a home or something else, but also on the business side, right? So if businesses have easy access to getting lines of credit at the bank, you know, we have other clients that have lines of credit based in their securities portfolios and it's a low rate. It's like, yeah, why wouldn't I go out and buy some stuff, make some investments, hire some people. And with that, you're just increasing the demand and vice versa. So when you raise rates, suddenly people feel like, you know what, maybe I won't necessarily go buy that new car. Maybe a business might say, hey, it's a little too high of an interest payment for me to make that investment, hire more people. By slowing down that side, the demand side, then the theory is that you start to bring down inflation. That's kind of where the interest rate raise comes from. They also can do things, and we don't need to go off in the details as far as what kind of purchasing that the government's doing in the way of quantitative, we won't go into that today, but quantitative easing, that can also, like you said, bring out liquidity. But all of those things are effectively trying to slow down or cool off the economy to bring down inflation.
Yeah, how, I don't know the cycles, but I'm guessing this probably, I think that interest rates, obviously, I'm not an economist, so I have no idea, but I think that interest rates will probably be high for a while for the next, it seems like everything is like in these massive cycles. I don't know. I was thinking it's probably going to be at least, my parents were telling me like 20 years ago that they, when they first bought their house, it was like a 15% interest rate back in the day. Like it was like really high. So I'm assuming that these things probably go in some sort of like long cycles. What's your thoughts on that? I know that this is not our forte per se, but any thoughts on like what your projections are?
Yeah, no, a couple of just fun facts. So we don't have to go, like I could probably nerd out, but people probably start turning off the podcast. But you know, a couple comments on that. So really since, like you said, the 80s where we had rates in the teens, we've pretty much been in a lowering rate environment since then up until this most recent rate rise. So it's been a long, they call it secular, right? Decades long period of time where rates are coming down. As far as where do rates go from here? And so to your point, as far as where do we feel like rates are going to go, It seems to me it's not unlikely that they hold for a period of time, a little more of a rate rise. But if they start to see things breaking, especially if unemployment starts going up, mm-hmm. it's possible they'll cut. I don't anticipate they'll cut it back to where it was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, where you had basically almost a 0% rate. It wouldn't be unlikely that the next 12 months or so, they do cut a little bit if we start to see signs of breaking. So it'll be interesting to see.
What's your thoughts on, I was looking at Tesla's site last night, and I was noticing that they were giving back like a $7,500 like rebate for taxes, and then $2,000, that was federal, and $2,000 for California. Why do you think that the government does stuff like that? It's obviously to, I guess, push like electric cars, but it does make sense to, like, I don't know, me as a consumer, if I'm going to go buy a car and you can buy like a Model 3 for like 40 grand and you're getting $10,000 back in some sort of like rebates, it makes the cost of buying the car a lot more attractive, I guess you could say. So like, what's your guess on like why the government does that? Is it just because they want to push more electric cars, or like, I would like to partake in that eventually, but I don't know. I think it's interesting. Yeah. These incentives.
Well, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with the last thing you said there was incentive. So much in economics and finance is incentive driven. When you have, as a government, and you could say even further as a society, if government being elected by society, and we go into that whole political conversation, but point being, if we as, government want to have more people driving, what we generally consider more environmentally friendly vehicles, then how do you incentivize people to do it? And you'll see that with taxes. So you think about the opposite, right? So you think about high taxes on like tobacco products, right? Mm-hmm. Cigarettes. So as a government, they decided we want to disincentivize purchases of tobacco, so we're going to like increase taxes. This is the opposite of that. We want to incentivize purchases of electric vehicles, so we're going to give you a tax break. They also give you a tax break for having kids. Like, we want to have kids in this country, so we're going to give you some tax breaks on having kids. For some of the folks listening to the podcast, there's R&D tax credits. There's R&D tax credits. You can go in and get a break on your taxes for doing research and development. Why is that? Because the government wants to encourage businesses to go out and innovate and make sure that the United States and our economy stays on the cutting edge. So it's all about incentives, like you said, and that's where those tax breaks are coming in.
Obviously not financial advice or anything like that, but like, what do you suggest people as far as like having like a portfolio goes, like individuals, if they have cash? Let's just say they have like a little bit of cash that they hold on to every month from their paycheck, 20% into investing, say 10% into savings. I don't know what the numbers might be, but is there like a general framework that you suggest for people as far as like kind of like keeping track of like just staying ahead and having a nest egg and whatnot?
Yeah. So it goes back to, what I said earlier, where you have rules of thumb, but then you need to also then start to incorporate the nuances of your life, your goals, your preferences. So from a cash flow perspective, usually what I would like to do is you kind of break it up into, some high level categories. Easy way to start, right? Some people go and they budget down to like, I pay this for my electric bill and I pay this on going out to eat. And that's great. I don't discourage that. But for folks that are just maybe busy or haven't got to that level of it, or just don't want to track it to that granularity, breaking it up into, usually we'll say five different buckets or uses of money. So you'd say living expenses. You say, like, to your point, growing and saving, that you, like you said, 10 to 20% is pretty good as far as a rule of thumb. Charitable giving that may be to a cause that's important to you. And then anything you put aside to either pay down debt or taxes. You can kind of break it into those categories. That's a great way, at least at a high level, to get started. And then at least you can say, oh my gosh, I'm paying a ton of my monthly income towards debt. May need to address that. Or, hey, I'm only saving 3%. Like that may not get me where I want to go long term. That's a good way to think about overall cash flow. And then specific to your question about where to put maybe some cash that's sitting around not doing anything, whether it's your, we talked about emergency fund, cash reserve, saving up for a down payment or business investment. A year and a half ago, 2 years ago, before the interest rate rise, you had to get a little more creative to try to make that cash work for you. Nowadays, one quick action I'd tell everybody on this who's listening to this, if you haven't already, take a quick peek at your bank account where you have cash sitting around, get a sense for what return it's providing. Take a look then at what else maybe your existing bank is offering in the way of a money market or a CD. And then if it's still pretty low, sub 3%, even sub 2%, there are plenty of well-known brand name institutions out there that you can put money into that'll give you, north of 4.5% on even just like a money market type of account. So again, not telling you to do that. I'm just saying it's probably worth your while to consider that, especially if you've got a significant cash balance that's just sitting there earning, 0.25% a year or something like that.
One thing that I've noticed too is that like the, I was playing around in like the stock market for a little bit, not a whole lot, just like, but, and a little bit in the crypto market. And I noticed that like, if you trade like in the short term capital gains, you really end up paying way overpaying. And I made that mistake, I think like 2 years ago, and I ended up paying quite a bit more than I should have on my taxes, which was painful. Is there any other things as far as, I guess, ending kind of side notes, like, is there anything that you want to leave us with as far as tips for a brokerage or an individual with regards to this conversation?
Yeah. So, you know, I would say a few things to think about. So first off, when it comes to, like you said, from an investment standpoint, it's all going to come down to really what your risk tolerance is. And that's like a mm-hmm. personal or business decision, that series of questions that, you know, we'll ask people that'll help us kind of tease that out. Mm-hmm. And then also your time horizon, right? So you could be the most aggressive individual or business that says, hey, we've got this extra cash on the sideline, let's go nuts with it. But if you need that money in 6 months, I'm going to most likely advise you that you be pretty dang safe with that money and keep pretty conservative, just because even if there's a low chance you're going to lose it, if there's a chance you're going to lose it and you need it in 6 months, that there's just not a lot of time to recover. And vice versa, right? If you have a long time horizon, even if you're a little bit more risk averse, may make sense to be a little more aggressive just to get that growth over time. So those are some risk tolerance and time horizon are ways to think about investments. You also mentioned then too, you know, you talked about getting hit with capital gains. You know, taxes are such a big part of, you know, what we do, and we think about liquidity, rate of return, risk. We talk about taxes. Those are all things to look at when you're considering how to invest, mm-hmm. Or just different factors. So those are the things that I would say, you know, as far as action items, as we're wrapping things up here, you know, I would say, again, some easy wins, right? Easy things. Go check your bank account if there's any substantial amount of money, and substantial is specific to you or your business, and just see what that rate of return is. And if it's, mm-hmm. again, sub 2 or 3, it's at least probably worth looking into another entity or another program with your existing institution that's going to pay north of that. At least to consider it, right? That's an easy action item for you. The other action item from a cash flow standpoint would be, like I talked about, breaking up those different buckets. So for businesses, the buckets are typically, an easy way to start at your business bank account is break up into a profit account. That's one. Tax account is 2. An operational expense account is 3. Like an owner's compensation account is 4. So that's good. It's a good place to start as far as saying every dollar that comes in gets allocated to those buckets. Depending on your business, you know, we could tell you what percentage goes into which, or should, or you should consider. But that's a good way, if you don't already track it that way and everything just kind of goes in one pot, that's a good way to think about your cash. And then on the personal side, we talked about it, but just same approach, but on a personal side, breaking into the living expenses, 1, that long-term growth savings investment bucket, 2, charitable giving, 3, like a debt and taxes as kind of the 4 and 5. If you break it into those, it's a little bit of work up front, but after you do that, then from there, you can update that as infrequently as once, twice a month, more frequently if you want, and you kind of get a better sense of how your cash flow is working.
Love that. Yeah, that was all really good stuff. So how do people reach out to you, Will, if they want to learn more? And what sort of clients do you look for as well, so the people in the audience know what sort of clients you take on?
Yeah, absolutely. So ways you can contact me is, you know, where I'm publishing content and pretty active is on LinkedIn. So it's an easy way to just either follow me or send me a direct message. Happy to answer any questions you have, or you can bounce ideas off me. I'm really looking to get more input from folks in the brokerage industry, freight brokerage, just to kind of continue to hone the services we're providing, and also email as well. As far as, you know, customers and clients that we're working for, really anybody in the freight brokerage industry that has questions pertaining to what we've talked about today, right? So either it's about, you know, cash flow, it's about, well, hey, I have the excess money. Hey, you know, are we investing or saving or allocating cash the right way? Are we paying too much in taxes? Are there some programs we should think about that could reduce that? Any of those questions, we're happy to answer. Again, our approach is usually very low stakes. You have a question, we'll try to answer it. If it makes sense for us to do, we usually do like an upfront diagnostic, a little assessment. Again, at that point, if you think that there's some information we've provided to you and some thoughts that we have that make sense for us to work more together, we can talk about that. If that's good enough for you, then go along your way. And that's kind of our gift back to the industry to kind of produce those diagnostics and assessments. But that's what we aim to do, try to just provide value and help people have a little bit more peace of mind about their finances. They can go do what they do really well.
Love it. Yeah. And they always creep up to you. If you don't, pay attention to them. The finances are so important. It's one of those things, like cash flow in general is just one of those things that people probably don't want to spend a lot of time thinking about. But at the end of the day, if like you don't have cash, you don't have a business. So I appreciate your time, Will. That was a very fun conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jeremy. Appreciate it. And look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks for sticking around to the end of that episode with Will. I always find it fascinating to talk to people about finances, and sometimes the boring stuff like cash flow is not necessarily fun to learn, but at the end of the day, if you don't have cash, you don't have a business. So hope you enjoyed that episode with Will. Be safe out there and enjoy your day.